without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. We have a very special guest tonight, but first let me introduce Marilia. Marilia, how are you? You got all your Christmas shopping done?
Well, not a big Christmas shopper. I'm not a big shopper anyway.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I've got all my kids coming home, and they're all expecting, you know, okay. Lots of stuff, I'm sure. So I'm going to brave it tomorrow morning. I'm going to go out to the mall because I tested negative for COVID the other day, so I'm feeling cocky all of a sudden. But tonight we have with us Kamon Freeman. Kamon started a station with another great guy called WEAC Radio. And those of you that listen to our show know that Marilia and I are now on that platform as well. So we're really happy to have this local celebrity, activist, and just all-around great guy, Kamon Freeman, with us tonight. Kamon, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure and honor.
Well, you know, let me start, Kamon, by telling you that when I came to your 10th anniversary party that Marilia unfortunately wasn't able to attend because she was out of town.
I was very disappointed.
Yeah, and you know what? I met so many people there that I knew that I was, you know, I saw so many people there like Ed Lazier and Reverend Hagler and Bill Lightfoot. I could go on and on and on. All these people that I've known in Washington for years. In fact, Hagler and Lazier have both been on the show before. So it just felt so comfortable to be there. It just felt like a place that I should have been a very long time ago. And I'd just like to add to that, that everybody that worked there went out of their way to make me feel comfortable. So thanks for that. And I'm really excited about being part of the WEAC family.
Yeah, thank you. And that I'd like to say that Eaton Hotel DC was the site location, and that mm-hmm. staff that you were complimenting, that they're probably the most politically aligned hotel in Washington, D.C. So if you're looking for the antithesis of the Trump Hotel, I would urge folks that are visiting Washington, D.C. to patronize the Eaton Hotel.
Yeah, and I bet you can get a drink for less than $23, too. You know, just throw that in there. It was a great event with a lot of great people. And I think what you're doing is, you know, putting on an activist radio station, which is really what the show is meant to be. It's meant to be, you know, we want to motivate people. We want to motivate people to care about D.C. statehood, obviously, but also other issues. There's so many issues out there, especially in our city. I know that you guys did a series or a piece called Anacostia Unmapped, which got 15 million gross impressions. Can you tell us about that? What motivated you to do that, and exactly what was that?
That's funny, because just here on December 18th, Saturday, 8 p.m., was the Story District annual hoopla they did at the Lincoln Theater. And Story District this wonderful group of storytellers who goes around curating stories to get people to perform them. And I always loved that platform because these wasn't comedians, these wasn't, you know, necessarily artists, but we felt that every human being, by the sake of their humanity, had one story the whole world could benefit from. You know, but oftentimes it's the one story they don't want anyone to know about, the one story they don't want to discuss or what have you. But that's the one story that the whole world could benefit from. And DCS, under different management, different ownership, rather, was a local publication, and they had printed an article advertising DC apartment, and there was a map. And on that map was Arlington and Alexandria. And for those outside of D.C., that is Northern Virginia. And, of course, before the Civil War, parts of Virginia was encompassed in D.C. D.C. was a diamond. It was a square. But the advent of Civil War, of course, Virginia seceded from the Union and took back their land. And so D.C. is a broken diamond. But this is supposed to be a map of D.C. apartment rental rates. So Virginia has somehow made it back into D.C., but yet Ward 7 and Ward 8, and again, for those outside of D.C., that's everything is east of the river, and that means the underclass, i.e. but the black people, the poor people, and they weren't on the map. So I had some, you know, I felt some kind of way. I'm like, okay, so east of the river is not part of D.C., but Arlington and Virginia are. Okay, got it. And so I wrote a letter to Jesus and the 12 disciples and got a response. And that's where that story took off from, when we say Anacostia unmapped, because we were no longer being seen. And that's what happens. You know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So we're here to amplify those voices. And maps have been one way of telling a story. It's been a one way of furthering a racist story with the history of cartography. For example, we have to acknowledge an ugly truth that Europe is not a continent. When we look at a map, you can see that there's no separation or near separation between Europe and Asia. But in fact, it's just one massive body of land. But we acknowledge this imaginary line, and we call it, or the powers that be call it, a separate continent. And they will make Africa smaller and America larger. And so that goes into a whole history that I think critical race theory has been challenging, is why they got them such in the armpits. And I was just blessed that story caught the attention of local lore, a D.C.-based media agency who had a federal grant to cultivate stories around the country of displacement. And that made it to NPR, and that story turned into, snowballed into a radio documentary where we were able to hire an activist, which was myself, and I hired a poet and a person who lived in a housing project. And these people interviewed people in their communities to get them to tell their stories. And then we got a grant from DC Commission on Humanities and turned that into a multimedia exhibition that was on display for about 6 weeks in the C8H Gallery in the lobby of DC Commission on Humanities. So it's all about doing what you can with what you have to tell stories and challenge the status quo. And I think that far too often we have allowed ourselves to be subservient to the status quo rather than challenging the status quo.
Well, I got to agree with that. And, you know, as you point out, we're particularly sensitive to the whole geographical racism or geographical, you know, discrimination as the District of Columbia, which was, you know, conceived and changed. Virginia got back its portion, as you point out, because they were afraid we were going to end slavery, which they were right about it. We were the first jurisdiction to end slavery. But there's a great book out there called How the States Got Their Shapes. And if you read it, it's really kind of a middle school book, geography book. But it's very interesting. In many, many states, the way the states got their shapes had to do with racism, money,
You said how the state got their shape.
Yeah, is the name of the book. And there are lots of, like, and, you know, like, there are, I can't remember exactly what the different states think, but there are some states which have a really straight, really strange shapes. They're not square. They're not round. They're not, you know, and it's all based on, you know, who was in power, slave state, non-slave state. You know, all these things. So politics always played a role in the way states were formed. But Marilee, go ahead. I'm glad you mentioned that.
And more importantly, that you said it was, you pointed out there was a middle school book, because oftentimes we adults, we think we're above any children's books. You know, what can we learn from a school book? Well, I learned in a school book and that. Let me say this slowly. Langston Hughes' grandmother, second husband, was Langston Hughes' grandfather. But her first husband died with John Brown at Harper's Ferry.
Oh. Huh.
And
well, there's so many
that made her, right? Yeah, that made her a widow of the men who fell with John Brown. And Theodore Roosevelt, for some godly reason, admired John Brown. And when he was no longer president, the opening of the John Brown Memorial Park, wherever it is. Theodore Roosevelt oversaw the festivities, and he brought up Langston Hughes' grandmother, who was the last surviving widow of the men who fell with John Brown, and brought her up on stage to speak. And so little Langston sees his grandmother, they're introduced by the former president, and that's the connection between Langston Hughes and John Brown. I got all of that from a children's book.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, knowledge is where you find it. I'm lucky enough to be married to a school librarian. So I get a lot of middle school and senior high school books. I think she believes I can only read at an eighth grade level, but she brings that stuff.
Well,
up. Go ahead.
That was more than a couple president.
Yeah, a couple of recent president, or at least one recent president. Go ahead, Maria.
Well, Kimbone, it's an honor to talk to you, and I'm disappointed I didn't get to meet you at that evening. I'm just impressed with everything you've done and how you've done it. And if I'm not mistaken, your middle name is Tecumseh?
Yes, it is. Native American.
And it's interesting because that was someone who fought for the right things like you. And I'm wondering how you got that name And if you think it has kind of set you for life and for the what you do and this and the things that you fight for and the successes that you've had.
Well, I think everyone should have the right to name themselves. And so this is the name I chose for myself because for Black people of enlightenment, you know, you have to understand that we basically, you know, to this day are carrying names that represent the families that own us. That's just a reality for African Americans. So I never had an affinity for the slave names that I was given. So that was the name that I chose. So my name is a deliberate decoration And so I'm glad you're familiar with Tecumseh, because when I learned about him, I felt that his story was one of those unsung heroes that needed to be highlighted. And I wanted to do my best to continue that legacy of resistance, and also highlight the whole African and Native American alliance that existed during that time. Because mm-hmm. what people don't realize is that one of the greatest slave resistant fugitive locations was Native American territories, particularly in Florida, Seminoles. And did you guys ever see the film Matthew McConaughey's film? And I should have that in front of me. Having a senior moment. But
yeah.
I think it was The Great State of Jones. The Great State of Jones. That was the name of it. You guys ever hear of that one?
No.
The Great State. Y'all should put that on your list during the holidays and watch it with the family. So The Great State with Jones, Matthew McConaughey was, I guess you'll call it a field doctor during the Civil War. He was working for the bad guys. He was working for the Confederate Army. And there was, if you deserted the army, you could be shot, you know, that type of thing. But at the same time, if you paid enough money, you could be exempt. So basically, if you owned slaves, which the war was all being fought over, you could be exempt. And if you didn't own slaves, then you got to fight. But so he already resented that, and I guess he just saw too much blood, and there was a young person in his family was killed, and so he went back home. And so they came for him and was trying to take his family's land and everything. So he went to flee, and what did he flee to? All these Confederate soldiers fled to the swamps where all the fugitive slaves were. So you had Confederate deserters and fugitive slaves working together that liberated spaces and territories within the Confederate-controlled territory during the Civil War. I knew nothing about this. So, that is what they don't want to teach. They don't want poor white people and poor black people and poor people of all races and ethnicities to realize their similarities and how they've all been exploited by a system that's designed to use division to maintain their status quo. And that's probably why you guys have not heard of Great State of Jones. So I would urge you guys to look that up. And I just wanted to put that on the radar of your audience, because we have more in common than we realize. I remember, the great Fred Hampton, he was talking about the Rainbow Coalition. People think that's Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson stole that from Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton, the great Chicago leader of the Black Panther Party, who was assassinated by the FBI and the Chicago Police Department. His family was awarded millions of dollars for that and was portrayed in the great film Judas and the Black Messiah. Had got all the gangs together. Had got not just all the black gangs, they got white gangs and Latino gangs to all call a truce and start working together. And they're like, oh, we can't have that. So whenever you hear these people talking about gang violence, and this is what they want. That's a desired condition that they want. Because if that didn't exist, then they would start turning their attention elsewhere into their real source of their problems, as opposed to this maintaining the status quo, where it's just chaos and disorder in communities of color and poor communities. So,
well,
just want to throw that out there.
You know, I've said this several times on the show, Kimone, that I was stunned. I have a master's degree in political science, and I was stunned when I saw the movie Amistad. I was, how could I not know about this? How could I not know that a president of the United States defended these slaves, these runaway slaves? This was such a big It seemed like such a big piece of our history.
You're not the only one, sir.
And here I am. I'm an educated, you know, I'm educated in our system. And American politics and American history were my, you know, those were my concentration. And I'd never, ever heard about it. But let me ask you something. Do you think that we're now coming to a new awareness about racism in America, an awareness that didn't exist before because of these things, because that it was, you know, so much of it was swept under the carpet? You know, they say that history is written by the winners, the people that win the battles and the people that are in power. It's not written by the people that are not in power. So do you think that the environment is changing now? Or are we coming to a new realization with, you know, the things that have happened over the last couple of years?
Well, I got to tell you, Senator, I always cringe when I hear people say we, because as a kid, I remember growing up watching Lone Ranger and Kim Osabi. So, and I just remember Kim Osabi someone saying, like, it was a joke a comedian was using. And he was saying, you know, Lone Ranger said that, you know, he was surrounded by the Native Americans. And Lone Ranger said, Kim Osabi, what are we going to do? We're surrounded. Yeah. And Kim Osabi's like, what do you mean we?
Yeah, exactly. No,
in that situation, what's we? You know? So anyway, I don't think we are moving there. I think some of us are, because, you know, we have to acknowledge that this is not the United States of America. This is, despite what Barack Obama says, you know, it's not a blue America. It's not a red America. It's the United States of America. No, sir. There is an opposition out there, and you can see it plainly. When we talk about critical race theory, you can see it plainly when we talk about voting rights. You can see it plainly when we're trying to pass any bills that are benefited of the people. The entire Republican Party is dedicated to fighting against it. Some people within the Democratic Party itself, Senator Joe Manchin and what have you, are fighting against anything that's of benefit to others. So, no, I don't think that we exist, but I think that the forces of goodwill are gaining momentum, and that this is their last stand, and this is why they're fighting to the bitter end. Like Charlton Heston, am I saying this right? Charlton Heston, whatever.
Charlton Heston, yes.
Yeah. When he says, "From my cold dead hands," you know, that's what we're dealing with. You know, there's a quote, and I'm sorry, guys. I'm a writer, and I pack quotes like this. This one has been attributed to both JFK and Bobby Kennedy. So I'm not sure which one it is, but hopefully your listeners can be better researchers than I. It says a revolution is coming, a revolution which will be peaceful if we're wise enough, compassionate if we care enough, successful if we're fortunate enough, but a revolution is coming. Whether we will it or not, we can affect its character, but not alter its inevitability. So I think that, you know, we have a situation where we are in the midst of a great revolution, and we have to realize that we have an unattainable situation. This structure that we have known as normal is not sustainable. The fact that we have, what is his name, Senator John Cornyn, a Texas Republican, said Democrats are delusional if they think they'll pass any new voting laws by the next election. So that's on one side. Chuck Schumer says he's bound to pass voting bills in time for 2022, but they just, correct me if I'm wrong, Senator, didn't Congress just go on vacation?
Yeah. And you know what? It's funny, because I just went to New York City, and guess who I slammed right into when I was at Penn Station was Chuck Schumer. And I asked him about voting rights and about the D.C. statehood bill. And he said, we have bigger fish to fry right now, basically. I mean, he said, ooh, yeah.
So like, he's letting you know where that part. He's letting you know where that priorities lie. He's telling you the truth, because he clearly was lying when he said that that he was vowing to pass voting bills in time for 2022. So I wish you had reminded him that Joe Manchin has been on a hunger strike since November 8th for voting rights. So I guess that's not a bigger fish for them to fry. But at the same time, that they passed the largest, I call it the War Department. I do not use the words that they use, the Edward Bernays public relations words, because it was the War Department before World War II, and then after they had a PR, they called it a defense budget. So people are not so against a defense budget.
Right.
They wasn't still in war, but it's the war budget. And since they have been, downsizing wars, withdrawing from wars, and they still just passed the largest war budget since World War II. And not only that, it's $20 billion more than what the president was even asking for. So that is a bigger fish that they can fry. They're all in agreement for. They're in agreement on that one. That's where their priorities lie. Their priority is not concerned about anything that's a benefit of the people, or challenging the inequities of the status quo, And again, I got to pull another quote out of a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual doom. That's MLK.
Well, so Chuck Schumer
and the people across the aisle, they're not reading the handwriting on the wall.
Well, I've got to agree with you again, but the Democrats, I've known this for a long time, and Murillo has too. Murillo was a Republican, is now an independent, but the Democrats have as much to learn as the Republicans do. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And part of our damn problem as Democrats, I think, Kimone, is that we talk down to the rest of the world, We know what's going on. We're not racist. We're not sexist. We're not, we've been able to avoid all these things, and we're going to tell you how things should be. But a lot of times we don't get it. And by the way, somebody out there needs to remind Joe Manchin that he is a Democrat. Joe's all about
you
the
sure
attention,
about that?
Right? Yeah, well,
you sure about that?
Somebody's got to remind them.
It also points to the fact that Democrats never get their message on the same page. Everybody's got this incohesive, fractured message that is just not part of. Whereas the Republicans always seem to line all the little soldiers up to talk and spout the same message and spin things the same way that they decided upon previously. But the Democrats never achieve that. And when you have a message that is splintered, it's not going to get across.
Well, and that's the old saying, isn't it, that when it comes to candidates, that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line, that they are a much more cohesive group. Let me ask you, what's really puzzling me these days, Kimone, is that in Wisconsin, which is a relatively liberal state, you have this, I don't know any other word to call him other than a murderer, this kid, Kyle Rittenhouse, who comes and murders two people, and he gets off. They don't even charge him with a gun violation. And then you have Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, who is hunted down and killed by these rednecks, and the people of Georgia stand up and do the right thing. They convict the right people. I mean, what's going on in America? go ahead.
Well, first, let me say that the Georgia case wouldn't have happened if the evidence wasn't presented by the actual accused
Right.
Because they were kind of like bragging over what they did. So they thought they were going to be safe, and that happened. And in fact, the prosecutor had done all in her power to protect them, but that video got out, and it turned. So that was the difference in those two cases. But I like to go back to the first live stream of the Civil Rights Movement on Emmett Till, when the little boy was brutally beaten, tortured, and murdered in Mississippi, and they got off, and sometime after the trial, they sold their story to a magazine, and they told the truth and admitted to the murders in a national publication after they was acquitted and there was not a problem. I mean, this is the mark, you know, just like, you know, we've had the official police report, you know, stood for eons until what? People had camera phones and start telling a different story and changing the narrative. And the outrage wasn't presented until people start seeing for themselves the disparity. Because before then, they didn't believe us, you know. And this has been going on for since we got here. This is nothing new. This is America. It's always been America. We have, whether of our, you know, ignorance or our willful ignorance, is been denying to ourselves what has been going on all this time. But I can assure you the people who have been suffering it can tell you. And that's where we are, because we're heading to a breaking point where we're going to have a situation that works for everybody or a situation that doesn't work for anybody. In fact, you know, D.C. Police Chief Conti tried to fire a couple dozen bad cops and was unsuccessful because of the bureaucracy in protecting them. He couldn't even fire. We're talking about cops accused of criminal misconduct. He couldn't fire them. You know, that's the system we have. You know, in 2006, the FBI, no friend of black people, by the way, 2006, the FBI has a report where they admitted that law enforcement, and that does not just mean cops, that means cops, prosecutors, judges, you know, law enforcement, that goes all the way up to the Attorney General, we're saying law enforcement, but has been infiltrated, quote-unquote, by white supremacists. And it's not white supremacists, it's a bunch of good old boys. You know, I'm a black kid from D.C. I used to love Dukes of Hazzard. Do you think anybody ever said, my parents or anyone else said, there was something wrong with me rooting for Robert General Lee to get away? You know? I mean, this is America. America is one big pot of hypocrisy. You know? We're the land of the free. But yet we have the largest prison system in the entire world. You know? This is the best country in the world. But yet we spend more money on health care and have the worst results. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, they call it the American dream because you have to be sleek to believe it.
Well, you know what? I don't want to monopolize the show here, Marilia, so jump in. But I've got to tell you, I've met Joe Biden. I've met the president several times. I followed his career for 40 years. I've been in politics. And I don't believe the man is a racist. But he just said something that he's taking criticism for. Because it is a racist remark, I believe, when he said, I don't know if you heard about this, where he gave a speech where he said black entrepreneurs are just like white entrepreneurs, except the white entrepreneurs have lawyers. Now, is it because, are we so casual about this? Is it so deeply rooted in, you know, who we are that we don't even think about things like that, that, right? We assume black lawyers are poor, right? We assume that our black entrepreneurs are poor and that white entrepreneurs can afford the lawyers. And I don't think he meant anything by it, but didn't he mean something by it? He didn't mean anything by it, I don't think, but doesn't it say something about us that even people
I would have to get the Yeah, I would have to get the context of that because this is the first time I'm hearing it. But my mm-hmm. gut reaction is that it rings true to me. What it sounds like to me, he's saying that, you know, the white business owners have a system that's there designed to support them, whereas black people have a system that's been designed not to support them. That's why you don't see black businesses talking about established in 1912. You don't see businesses along that long. You know, there's a reason for that, okay? I'm not convinced that he's not racist because, you know, he's definitely not, a racist like Trump's a racist. But let me just point out, again, another film. This film is A Night in Miami. A Night in Miami had the story of Malcolm X, Jim Brown, and Sam Cooke, who was friends, who spent the evening that Muhammad Ali won the championship together in Miami, right? And and the lead up to this to that mythical night, Jim Brown was home visiting some of his supporters, and he went to the big house to see the whoever the big guy was on I think he lived on some islands in Georgia, some of the Geechee Islands or whatever, and he's having lemonade on the porch, and the daughter's bringing him out stuff, and all the hospitality, and the big man's telling him, you know, how much he loves him and how much he admires him, and that his greatest pride is, you know, not the big house he owns, not his family. His biggest pride was to tell people that he's from the same town as Jim Brown, right? Mm. This is what this man says to him. He loves him. Says, Jim, if you ever need anything, I want you to know, just call me. And then his daughter comes out and says, you know, Dad, I'd hate to interrupt you, but I still need to get that dresser moved from downstairs before we get the room painted. And I said, oh, baby girl, I'm sorry, I forgot all about it. So Jim, being, you know, big, strong man, he said, you need help moving furniture? And the guy says, oh, Jim, that's so nice of you, but you know we don't let niggas in the house. So he was a benevolent racist. See, your racist doesn't mean that you hate black people. And you see, this is America. It's a slippery slope. So I can't say, I don't know Joe Biden. I can't say he's not racist because I don't know him. But I do know that he gave the eulogy to the longest serving racist congressman, and that was Strom Thurmond. So my suspicions are there. So at least he has some sympathies for racists. But so I just wanted to say I can't. I'm always hesitant to say who's not racist, you know, because any white man that's from America who has been here the entire life, who claims he's not a racist, but doesn't know no racist. that's very suspicious to me. I'm like, you don't even have an uncle? because in America we want to acknowledge it's a racist country, except for, you know, Kamala Harris agrees with the highest ranking black Republican, Tim Scott. They both claim that America is not a racist country, but except for those two Negroes, everyone else admits that America's a pretty racist country, but no one wants to admit who's racist.
Well, I think it's a very complicated issue, and I'm going to tell you a brief story right now, and then I'm going to shut up for a while so my co-host can speak. But, you know, I was lucky.
The lovely ballerina.
Yeah, my lovely ballerina, right. Thank God. You should be able to see her on Skype, not me. But, I was lucky to grow up in a family where My mother worked in an all-black school. She loved the black children, but she believed every stereotype about black people. We used to say to her, Mom, you know, she was a wonderful person, but we used to say to her, Mom, what do you think happens when they turn 18, when people turn 18? I mean, you love them as children. You love black people as children. Then when they grow up, you're afraid of them. And I actually came home from middle school one day. When I was a little boy, my sister, who was 10 years older, her and her friends. I grew up in North New Jersey, and her and her friends used to, we were poor and we lived in a little place, and her and her friends used to dance in the basement, and they taught me how to jitterbug as a little kid. So I come to nice white Montgomery County, and they have a jitterbug contest in my middle school. And who do I ask to dance with me? Teresa Bennett, one of like three black girls in the whole school. She's a great dancer. And guess what? We win the contest. And I end up on the front page of the like little school newspaper, me and Teresa with the trophy. This threw my mother into a self-induced coma. Now, here's a woman that...
Oh, wow.
I said to my sister, what's wrong? And she showed me the picture and just shook her head like, you know, Mom, Michael, what are you going to do? And that's the thing. My mother was never mean to a black person. I would be so surprised if she ever did anything, you know, that was mean to a black person, or she loved all the black children that were in her care and they loved her. But on the other hand, she believed every, you know, and I don't know if I'm right or not, but I always wrote it off to ignorance, that she didn't understand. She interacted with people, but she really never really got to know them. And that's, you know, I always say the difference between Ward 3 and Ward 8 for me is when I show up for a meeting at Ward 3, people say, what have you done for me lately? When I show up to a meeting in Ward 8, the first thing everybody says to me is, thanks for coming. So,
well, Senator Brown, it wasn't just your sweet mother. You know, since we're going to have, confessions, my mother thinks that if you don't have Jesus in your life, you're going to hell. So she hates Muslims and Hindus. You know, if you ain't Jesus, you're going to hell. You know, so we're getting away from a lot of that old thinking, and hopefully we can, make a new world out of some new thinking.
So go ahead, Morelia. We're both Catholics. We both believe that if you're not a Catholic, you don't go to hell necessarily. But
I think my mother approves of Catholic.
We get the best seats. I think we figure because we know somebody. So go ahead. I'm sorry, Morelia. I'm monopolizing things.
That's all right. I was enjoying your repartee with Kimon, so it's great. Kimon, I hear you, and I am so with you. But I wonder, in terms of racism, in terms of Biden, you never know until you know what's in somebody's heart and what's in somebody's mind. And, you know, like the late, great Mike Sonner used to say, unless you've held the lantern, you just don't know. But, you have to look at people's behavior on the outside and on the whole. For the majority of his behavior, I don't think he is. He is a very compassionate man. And I think that is a very important part of not being racist, is being compassionate for each other and understanding what our plight or what each other's plight is. And I think also... understanding, and I don't think people understand this, that we all really come from the same patrilineal DNA from Africa. We're all from the same Adam, dating back about 230,000 years back to Africa. And I think, until people can swallow that, I think that we will always, but people will always think, I'm different. I'm not that. And that person is black and I'm white. And there's a difference. But I think we need a lot of compassion in this society. And I think you gain compassion by experience and by actually stepping in each other's shoes. For me, growing up in Brazil, having been born in Brazil, I still have in my mind as a 6-year-old, and my mother was very, very compassionate, and she taught us a lot. And she used to take us to see the blacks, the poor blacks in the favelas. and used to help them. And there was just huge compassion. Our maids were Black, and she treated them like they were part of the family. And as a child, I learned that. And I learned that there really is no difference. And the thing that really sticks in my mind in terms of the plight of the other man, of the other colored man, if you will, is something I witnessed outside of our condominium when I was about 6 years old in Brazil. And that is a bunch of workers. And in Brazil, it's different. It's changed a little bit, but it was different. These people are extremely poor, and they were digging ditches. And I think there was a water leak. And the ditch must have been, it was like probably 10 feet deep, maybe 3 feet wide. And there was dirt on the outside that they had dug out. And the rains came, and somehow, and I don't remember the details because I was a child, but I remember witnessing this, the dirt came in and covered them. And it just felt like an avalanche back into the hole. And they were covered. And I knew they were covered. My mother was panicking, and no one could dig them out fast enough, and they died. And the next thing I see is one of their children, this little Black boy who came down from the favelas with his father's dinner, and that just killed me. And I remember as a six-year-old just crying and walking back into our condominium. My mother told me to go away. And walking up the stairs, we didn't have an elevator, it wasn't that tall of a building, walking up the stairs and feeling my tears hit up against the tiled wall and just thinking how awful that was. And I think that stuck with me. I know it stuck with me for all these years of my life. And it has created huge empathy in me and huge compassion because I knew those people were poor. They had nothing. And they died. And there was this little boy there holding his father's dinner. And from that day, and I think what's important, and I don't know how we do this, but I think we need to instill compassion in people. And I think the only way to do it is somehow, whether it's through virtual reality or what. And I think you do a great job with that, Kamon. But teach people, what is it like to be in somebody else's shoes? That's the definition of empathy, truly. And unless you have that, you just don't know. You will never know, and you're unable to understand. But Kamon, you have a brilliance and a sharp intellect and a unique awareness and perspicacity and a strength of spirit that has allowed you to create this incredible network, this web of unique messages and very precise messages that really speak the truth.
We have Kamon Freeman with us. And
Kamon, it's been wonderful. And I just hope that in spite of that internet glitch that you were able to hear what I said. And I just wanted to also add that I know you've done amazing things with the American Friends Society. With you've been to Kibera in Kenya, and I've been there too. And there are a lot of similarities between Kibera and Anacostia. I think that the situation of Kibera in Kenya is much more dire than Anacostia, but there are the same threads that run through it, the same socioeconomic threads and the same background threads, which I think is something that really needs to be to receive a human focus in order to fix this problem.
Yeah, yeah. And I appreciate you sharing your story as well as the center sharing the stories, because I think the stories are important, and I think that is what resonates most with people. And for those who do not know, you know, Brazil is the country that has the largest population of Africans outside of Africa. And then, of course, America is the second largest outside of Africa. But and I think that, you know, Brazil currently has a Trump figure as well. And so I think that what we're seeing is the last stand of this good old boy network of inequity that is starting to change. We're moving towards a more equitable society. And that more equitable society doesn't have spaces to maintain millions of people, billions of people living in poverty, $2 a day, so a handful of billionaires can fly to the moon, you know, for fun. That is not the world that we need to be living in. And when the senator says that, you know, D.C., the last colony of America, in order for that to be true, that means we have to make a stand against colonialism. But we're still seeing colonialism being perpetrated. You know, Elon Musk even calls his program the colony on Mars, you know. And so we need to address that. And we don't need to, change the hearts and minds of racists. You know, Lyndon B. Johnson was a big racist. He used the N-word like candy. He's from Texas, you know. One of the most despicable white men on the face of the earth is from Texas, and that's from Robert Duvall, another movie quote, by the way. But he passed more legislation that benefited African Americans than anybody else, you know. So that's why I say America is a land of hypocrisy, you know. And we need to expose that. And let me close by saying that, you know, when we say taxation by representation, this describes a populace that is required to pay taxes to a government authority without having any say in that government's policies. That has been the status of black people and people of color in this country throughout its founding, okay? And it wasn't until recently that black people were granted the right to vote in earnest, in actuality, not on paper, and that is still being challenged today. And it goes back to the origin of the slogan with American colonialists was fighting against their British rulers. Taxation without representation is tyranny, and that's what we're dealing with still in Washington, D.C., and I like to thank the district government for their small part, because when they added the taxation without representation to the license plates, I believe that was around 2000 or so, that was a source of pride and awareness. But in 2017, they added one more word to the phrase that I think made all the difference, and it says "in taxation without representation," and so that is why I like to close with. I think that we're meeting the end and a new beginning. And having said that, most people are familiar with Martin Luther King's last speech, but they're not as familiar with his next to his last speech, which was delivered right here in Washington, D.C., March 31st, 1968, and was entitled "Remaining Awake During a Great Revolution." He said that far too often people find themselves living in periods of great social change, but yet they failed to develop the new ideas and new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution. I submit that's the very definition of stay woke, and that's why the Republican Party is trying to turn it into a pejorative. And so hopefully your audience and our audience will continue to grow and continue to stay woke. Do something.
Well, I'm back, y'all. You know, I can hear you now, and that's a great place to leave the show. And, you know, I haven't said anything for the last few minutes because you guys are doing a better job than I did.
I don't think so, Mike, for my part anyway.
No, that's not true. Come on, Freeman. We're so happy to be part of your family. We look forward to a long relationship trying to get people to do something. Because that's what it's all about. So thanks for tuning into our show this week. I think next week we're going to take off Morelia because it's Christmas. You know, we'll see what we can dream up for each other. But I want to end our show tonight by dedicating this song to Kimon and all the people at WEAC. We usually end with the song, and this is from a favorite play of mine about the Elephant Man, because I feel like I'm the Elephant Man of politics. You know, people don't really want to look at me, but I am unique. And this is a great song. It's entitled "Feels Like Home." Thanks, folks.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
All the best in the new year.